Dámy a pánové, dobré ráno. Dovolte mi, abych vás přivítal na druhém dni konference věnované komunistickým režimům ve střední a východní Evropě jako společnému dědictví. Název té konference je 20 let poté. Vztahuje se samozřejmě k tomu 20. výročí, které v letošním roce si připomínáme. Je mojí povinností, ale zároveň radostí přivítat mezi námi pražského arcibiskupa, jeho eminenci kardinála Miloslava Vlka. A tím, že otvírám druhý jednací den této konference, tak zároveň zahajuji blok referátů, které jsou věnovány životnímu stylu a kultuře každodennosti v období pozdního komunismu. Složení našich referujících je, jak vidíte, pestré. Ve dvou případech se vlastně jedná o dvou referát, tedy nebude nás mluvit tolik, kolik nás tu sedí, o něco méně. Složení je pestré, co se týče národnosti účastníků. První referát je věnován postkomunistickému syndromu jako duchovnímu odkazu s podtitulem Teoretický rámec a praktická zjištění. Jeho autory a přednášejícími jsou paní Martina Klicperová-Baker, která pracuje na Akademii věd České republiky v Ústavu psychologie, a profesor Ivo Feyerabend ze San Diego State University, Department of Political Science. Prosím, máte slovo.
The Velvet Revolution during the Annus Mirabilis of 1989 was a national epiphany of freedom and democracy, enthralled the civilized world, watched in fascination and admiration. A Czech colleague in New York confessed that at the time she was so moved and the world seemed so good at such a place to be that at that moment she would have gladly died. And yet, after 20 years, according to survey study conducted by Klicperová-Baker and Košťál, as illustrated in graph 1, you'll see the graph. Yes, the plurality of 36% of respondents were neither pleased nor regretful about the changes which followed communism. 8% had great regrets, and 19% were somewhat regretful. And so, after 20 years, only 33% of respondents in this representative national sample were associated with the glorious promise of the Velvet Revolution, while full 66% were indifferent or it rejected it outright. How disconcerting. What a disconnect with the promise of the revolution. As an explanation, let me suggest as a hypothesis the extreme situation administered by the ancien regime of totalitarianism. There are two relevant, indeed famous, studies of extreme situation and reprehensible behavior on the part of the experimental subjects. The first is by Stanley Milgram at Yale University. His results showed that most people will deliver a lethal dose of electricity to another subject if instructed to do so by scientists in a white lab coat. Only a small minority of the experimental subjects in this bizarre situation, the heroes, said no. The other study is by Philip Zimbardo in the basement of a building at Stanford University. He simulated a prison situation there. Zimbardo had to interrupt the experiment when the situation started to resemble Abu Ghraib, here at Stanford, as well as in Iraq. There were a few courageous individuals, the moral heroes like Lieutenant O'Sutton, William Kimbrough, the Navy dog handler, who blew the whistle and sounded the alarm. By the way, in the briefing of the experiments at Yale and Stanford, some subjects were found to be so traumatized by the experience that they needed psychological counseling. Well, the specter of totalitarianism is, of course, by far more severe. It certainly exceeds by so many measures the experimental situation. And of course, the totalitarian regime is placed at the extreme negative end of the spectrum of political systems. As a reminder, a very short one, let me quote Joseph Joffe. He says, "Consider the gruesome numbers, regular war in the 20th century, has killed 30 million, but this figure pales when compared to the 170 million civilian massacred by states and regimes like the Soviet, German, or Chinese. Once the extreme situation passes, as after the Velvet Revolution, it is easier to forget or deny the trauma on the past of participants rather than hold to it with clarity. Why? For guilt, opportunism, familiar conflict, shame, bleeding heart, stealth, search for impunity, as well as arrogance and solidarity on the part of the perpetrators of the extreme situation, the totalitarian regime. So, no wonder that it took almost 20 years of strenuous effort and incremental piecemeal progress and frustration on the part of the courageous and principled few, as well as their struggle with the stalling authorities, the resisting old structures, the communists, and the indifference of the public opinion, when finally the two important steps were achieved, namely to redress the loss of memory and history, that is to say the security service archives were fully opened, and the Institute for the Study of Totalitarian Regimes, and this conference was established. Let me stress, and this should be repeated, I think, that these are critical tools for the democratic socialization that may now start anew again. Masaryk's heritage came to life again. After all, truth was at the top of his hierarchy of values. Reiterating the wisdom on Santayana, the Harvard professor, the law providing for the archives and the institute states in the preamble, he who does not know his past is condemned to repeat it. And Archbishop de Béranger said it really with great meaning and eloquence when he was apologizing for the lapse of memory of the Church of France to the survivor of the Holocaust. He said, conscience is formed in memory, and no society can live in peace with itself on the basis of a false or repressed past, any more than an individual can. At the end, very fast, let me suggest that, as the question, when will the struggle for the past, boje o minulost, will come to an end? When the public consciousness will be able to equate the horrors of communism with the horrors of Nazism? When the Communist Party disappears, when the 33% of the survey indicating a preference for democracy will turn into a vast majority, when the euphoria of the Velvet Revolution will be transfigured into a true internalized democratic creed, and when the muckers, the victims and their families may finally get the sense of closure for their personal and national tragedy. Thank you.
Děkuji profesoru Feyerabendovi za vstupní referát. Možná je vhodné v tuhle chvíli zdůraznit, že jeho spoluautory byla rovněž Martina Klicperová-Baker, která je mezi námi přítomna, ale také profesor Jaroslav Košťál, který se nemohl zasedání této konference zúčastnit. Po té vstupní úvaze o postkomunistickém syndromu, který tu byl představen z různých aspektů i psychologických, jako tíživé dědictví minulosti, bude následovat referát našeho rumunského hosta, paní...
Ano?
Aha, tak to jsem... Jo, tak to jsem... Jo. Takže ještě bude následovat koreferát k tomuto referátu od paní Martiny Klicperové-Baker.
Hello everybody, Mr. Chairman, dear friends and colleagues. Já budu mluvit anglicky tedy, tím se omlouvám českým mluvčím. We are one of the double papers that is in this panel. So apology to the Czech speakers that I will be speaking English. Then I wanted to apologize a bit that I will be a bit Czecho-centric, so I'm apologizing to the non-Czech natives. And maybe final apology about the slides. Yesterday I noticed that our heads are blocking a little bit from the lower part of the slide, so I moved them up, and now I notice that it's cut off on the top a little bit, so I will help you to read and when it will not be quite readable. So are we talking about the post-communist syndrome, about the mental heritage from another point of view? I will offer you a bit different perspective, maybe a bit complementary, and my perspective may be a bit different because I was not blessed to be a part of the greatest generation as Professor Feyerabend was. I have lived under the totalitarian regime most of my life, and also I'm a psychologist, more than political scientist or political psychologist. Dr. Košťál has contributed to this, and I wanted also to stress that there is a society of political psychology. If you are interested in this field of study, it's a very interdisciplinary field, so you may be invited to the internet site to have a look at it. As we know, life under the totalitarian regime encourages development of specific pathological maladaptive symptoms. This is an attempt to put them into a systematic perspective from individual level, interpersonal as far as to societal level, and across various personality and mental aspects. Professor Farabet mentioned already, suppressed individuality, anxiety, learned helplessness, etc. If you would be interested more in this, we can provide you with supplementary literature. We label it as post-totalitarian syndrome or post-communist syndrome. It has its active as well as passive aspects. But also, as Professor Farabet mentioned, they are heroes. Not everybody suffers from post-totalitarian syndrome. And we know, for example, by Viktor Frankl, a hero in concentration camp. We have hero dissidents like President Václav Havel, who mentioned that totalitarianism may not be just oppressive, but it can also provide a special opportunity. If I can quote from Václav Havel, a person who cannot move and live a normal life because he is pinned under a boulder has time to think about his hopes more than someone who is not trapped in this way. And so we may have a special opportunity, we may have had a special opportunity to think about freedom and to appreciate it even more afterwards. This post-totalitarian syndrome or post-totalitarian mentality has been noticed in many other countries. This is just a little sample from literature that I found that is relevant to it, from Russia, Poland, Georgia, Romania, etc. Again, the literature is available if you would be interested more. Professor Feyerabend mentioned already some of the studies that we are together working on. This was a finding that kind of stunned us, because when people asked about how happy they were about the transition to freedom, this is the same label, the same graph. We were a bit stunned that they were not overwhelmingly happy. So how happy are you about transition from before 1989 till now? You see, with great joy, it was about one-third of people. With great joy and rather with joy, one-third of people. Another third felt neither joy nor regret. And another almost a third either regretted very much, or didn't know how to answer. This finding was very much matching studies by CVVM, the Czech agency at Sociological Institute. Again, you can see the thirds here. The black cubes, like represent people who feel better now than before, and now it's about one third again. The yellow triangles feel half and half, past and now, another third. And the last third, pretty much, is composed from people who thought that it was better before 1989, or people who just do not know or do not care. And as far as how much I am afraid of post-communism and post-communist mentality, I am feeling a bit more fear, actually, from that growing number of people who don't know and who don't care, because I see this is another danger that we have to face, not just the heritage of post-communism, but also the growing number of people who don't care and who don't know. And these are not just very young people. These are also, we looked into the sociology of it, people in their 20s and 30s. So that's worrisome. So what's happening with those people who don't appreciate freedom, maybe, as Professor Farabent suggested, or who feel worse now? We try to ask more and to analyze more what's going on. So if you look at the columns in red, of course it's just for impression, not for study. I can give you the details of it. This is what bothered people more very intensely in the past, items that bothered very intensely in the past. The lighter columns are that are very bothersome now. And as far as people very much were sorry that they couldn't travel and they didn't have free speech, and that bothered them very much in the past, it's much easier to complain about things now. And indeed, democracy seems to fail or really fails to deliver some very important values that people depend on. And very often it's economic problems, it's feelings of safety. Very often, and most often actually, the first column illustrates that people are very disgusted and annoyed by lies and corruption in politics. So it's not just non-democrats that are complaining the current regime. The positive thing is that people are complaining about politicians and not about politics. When we asked about the past, people were complaining about politics. Now they are complaining about politicians. But anyway, people suffer actually from frustration of very important values. And if you know Maslow's theory of needs and important aspects of life, it may be a bit harsh to reprimand people for losing revolutionary ideals if they are missing safety, and if they are afraid of crime, and if they lost jobs. So this is just maybe for discussion. Mm-hmm. But we are also, this is a question about whether they experienced and how they experienced the police state. How did, so we asked about details. So how did they experience the police state and practice of informing before 1989? And this is actually encouraging. Most people, one third, were extremely bothered by the communist police state. Another almost quarter, very bothered. Almost 20%, quite bothered. So Czechs, for the most part, are very aware of the totalitarian past and totalitarian wrongdoings, and they scorn the regime. So that, so if we are going to the details, I would say it's encouraging. And now, at least briefly, this was research of public opinion, opinions that are going up and down in according to the situation in the society. We are also trying to study something more stable, let's say psychological predispositions of democracy, political culture, democratic ethos, and civic nationalism. And we call this Feyerabend Trinity in respect to Professor Feyerabend, who is kind of a trailblazer in this research. And since the Czechs are, I'm afraid to say, especially in present, Czechs are rather agnostic, maybe instead of Trinity for the Czech environment, we can speak about this Trinity as about kind of a tripod on which democracy is firmly standing. So we were studying political culture in Czechs, and also in comparative study in Bulgaria, in Belarus, Slovakia, etc. We studied how interested people are in politics, whether they don't get alienated if things don't go wrong, how active they are. Mm-hmm. And through statistical factor analysis and cluster analysis, we found that in Central Europe, there are these four major aspects, major factors of politics. And especially in Czech environment, we found encouraging results. A very substantial part of the Czech population has robust civic culture, which is partly probably heritage from the First Republic, but still something that survived and that is very encouraging for the current transition. Then we studied civility. Again, honesty, tolerance, authoritarianism, experience of freedom, work ethics, etc. We found four major factors. Again, it was a comparative study of several Central European nations. The major factor there was dependent and safety-seeking negativistic post-communism, that post-communist syndrome as we theorized it in the beginning. But I don't know how much you can see, but you can guess it was another factor that was actually prevailing in the Czech environment. Does it resonate if you know the Czechs or if you are a Czech native? Which one of the four maybe was most typical for the Czechs? It was actually factor three, tolerant, bon vivant, liberalism, that appeared as a major one. And that may be pretty good disposition for democracy in that tolerance and liberalism, although there is still some problems with morality. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we don't see the top. We were also studying the substance of nationalism. On top was constitution, equality, language, and all the others that you may see were the items. We were asking people how much do they relate their feeling of Czechness with these items. You may probably guess that what was in the beginning, the strongest for most nations actually is language. But for the Czechness was important language. Second was freedom and human rights. So there is that good coincidence of civic and ethnic values. Mm-hmm. Third was culture. For Moravians, actually, there was also food and national food and drinks. And you may probably guess what was on the last. Unfortunately, it was the religion was the least Czech items from the ones that were presented. Thank you. You can do this little experiment yourself. You can think of your nation or Czech nation and try to sketch a lifeline of a nation. This is a representative sample, kind of averaged representative sample. You can see the wars are the dips. But why I'm bringing it here is that I see some optimism in the fact that in average Czechs seem the future of Czech Republic optimistically. It goes up, so democracy, we shall overcome the obstacles. And one more. And one more kind of an optimistic thing. If people were asked, was the Velvet Revolution worth it?
Já se omlouvám, ale budeme muset přejít záhy k dalšímu referátu.
So were the changes worth it? Was the change of 1988, the change of the regime, worth it? Absolute majority says yes, definitely yes, or rather yes. And those who are hesitant are in the background. So just as a conclusion, we are finding remnants of post-totalitarian syndrome and we are worried by it. But maybe even more, we should be worried about ignorance and disinterest. And that's also why education and also the Institute for Research of Totalitarian Regimes is so important. Thank you very much. Thank you. Děkuji za pozornost.
Děkuji tady doktorce Klicperové Baker za koreferát a předal bych slovo další referující. Další referující je paní Elena Arhire z Mezinárodního konferenčního centra z Budapešti. Její referát je věnován tématu, které tu zatím nezaznělo, ke kterému tu zatím nebyly žádné příspěvky, to jest ke kinematografii, a to pod názvem Stát na tvůrčím poli, znovu oživení rumunské kinematografie. Prosím o slovo.
Thank you. Well, first of all, my paper is entitled Creative Field of the State Refounding the Romanian Cinema. And I shall start my presentation with a quotation. And I quote Ralph Dahrendorf's questions. Are we witnessing not a process of dissolution without anything taking the place of the old and admittedly dismal structures? What will happen to cultural life? Do we have to read and watch trash now that we are free and no longer have inexpensive books and subsidized quality films? End of quotation. In fact, these questions, I think, are relevant and pertinent if we think about cinema in Eastern Europe after 1989. And, of course, I concentrate on Romania because I know better the example of it. I'm sorry. And it is important to focus on Romanian cinema, because before 1989, communists concentrated a lot on this industry. It was in fact one of the most important cultural industries in communist Romania. It was a creative field strongly sustained by the state. And after 1989, it is interesting to see what was the destiny, let's say, of this creative field that suddenly stops in having the state protection, but still remains dependent on the state. This is why I entitled my presentation Creative Field of the State, because after 1989, even though we don't have the monopoly of the state over the production or the distribution of the films, cinema functions using financial support of the state, and because doing movies is not quite easy, it is important to have a sum of money in order to start your project. And why such an analysis? Because, of course, we don't talk only about arts, but we talk about the relation between arts and politics, and the way in which politics can interfere and can, at a certain point, develop arts, and how the new institutional framework can in fact shape a new order of things. And also, maybe you have heard, there is in Romania nowadays the new generation of directors that have a quite interesting success at an international level. And the success of those new generation directors actually imposed a sort of rediscussion of the role and the functions of cinema in Romania and the role that state has in the shaping of this field. And also, it is important to notice the fact that in 1989 and after 1989, Romanian cinema actually is confronted with what was called the disappearance of the old routines. These old routines were understood as that state monopoly, that centralized and monolithical system that actually didn't permit any private or individual action in this field. And because cinema was considered, and here I quote again Boris Groys, saying that cinema was in fact a socially useful art, understood as a tool of educating, of preparing, of simply showing people what was officially correct and officially permitted. And well, this sort of routines, that monopoly of the state, is lost in 1989. At that time, for example, the private actions are allowed, and it is interesting to see how directors do manage post-communism. What is also important to see is the fact that I stress this idea in my paper. In fact, what I wanted to show by talking about cinema in Romania was that that continuity of the structures, of the functionaries, is a thing that is pertinent for the cinema also. We were talking about this continuity of the structures all along this conference, and it is really a very important debate, this one, of what should we do and how should we manage post-communism, but with communist actually functionaries and mentality. And I will presents a bit the Romanian system cinematography, it is important to know that I focused on one institution that is called the National Center of Cinematography. It is an institution founded in 1936, but that was reorganized by communists in 1948 and then in 1972. And it was the only institution, of course, helped by the Committee of Cinematography and the Committee of Censorship in Romania. It was the only institution that organized and regulated Romanian cinematography in those 40 and some years of communism in Romania. And in 1989, what does it happen? Another very specific characteristic for the Romanian system, political system, was the reorganization of this institution, but how only at a denominative level. So this institution was called before 1989 the Central Romania Film. It becomes the National Center of Cinematography, and we have this institution starting with February 1990. And also this institution, of course, regulating this this field of creation, it is important because it is the only one that does that. It is important on one other hand because it is the one who actually which permits the obtaining of the state subsidies. And this is the problem also because mainly the new generation of directors in Romania has always this tendency to contestate, in fact, the way the National Center of Cinematography gives those money. Why? Because I told you, I already said that the functionaries are still the same as those before 1989, and they are always considered as the main figures and the main elements for corruption. And that's what they do in this state institution, in fact, is to perpetrate the old routines that the communists had, because in the communism, the way of passing of a movie was not only the movie accepted, were not only the movies that were good for the official version of the reality, but also those movies that were organized or proposed by people who were good for the officials. Let's say it is also important to know that censorship, of course, was very very powerful at that time in 1989, and that a lot of movies, mainly after the 70s, were censored. And maybe you know the example of Lucian Pintilie. He is one of the most famous Romanian directors. In 1972, he was expelled from Romania because he was considered, in fact, too dangerous. And because I was talking about you, to you about the idea of censorship, if we had the censorship of the authorities before 1989, after 1989 we have the censorship of the economical, new economical order. So nowadays, and after 1989, state was not that involved in the process of production, but still had an important role because of those state subsidies that I was talking about. And finally, what I would like to accentuate also, it is the way the network, the distribution network, actually evolved after 1989. For example, in the year of the fall of the communism, we had in all Romania 612 theater movies, and in 2007, less than 70. Also, this sort of collapse of the interests in movie was felt also in the interests of the spectators. In fact, if in 1990, a year after 1989 and the fall of communism, there were registered some 130 million views in the cinemas, in 2004, there were only 4 million. And finally, I would like also to focus a bit on the movies that were made after 1989. I simply organized this period of 20 years in two different parts, 1989-2000. And if you see movies realized in those times, you will see that there are a total symbol for the freedom of expression and the way this freedom of speech and of visual effects was understood by directors. Maybe you will find movies being made too daring, too violent, too direct. And what the definition of those times in Romanian cinema was understood under the expression of the fight over the glaciation of memory. It was yet again Lucian Pintilie who insisted on this idea of the social and political function that cinema had to assume after 1989 in order to never forget the past. And the second period of time in Romanian cinema, I would say, is concentrated after 2000, with that new generation of directors that I told you about. And what they do, besides criticizing the past, is the need and the necessity of explaining and assuming this past, which is, I think, the most important part that art should assume also. And I finish my presentation here, hoping that maybe you will be now a bit more interested of this field of the Romanian cinema. Thank you.
Děkuji paní Arahire za to, že nám představila proměny rumunské kinematografie v posledních 20 letech, které zřejmě jsou opravdu výrazné, jak o tom svědčí i nedávná pražská přehlídka rumunského filmu posledních několika let. Z níž je zřejmé, že současní rumunští tvůrci se nevyhýbají ani takovým situacím, jako je zachycení, zobrazení antitotalitní revoluce z prosince roku 89 na plátně. Dalším referátem je referát našich dvou maďarských hostů. Pan Tamáš Domboš pracuje na Středoevropské univerzitě v Budapešti, a to na oddělení sociologie a sociální antropologie. Spoluautorkou tohoto referátu je paní Lena Pelandini-Šimáni, která působí na London School of Economics and Political Science, rovněž na oddělení sociologie. Profesí obou autorů, tedy sociologií, je dáno i téma jejich příspěvku, který se dotýká sociálních vrstev, sociálních skupin a jejich reakcí na ekonomické a politické proměny, a to pod názvem Dělníci, občané a spotřebitelé, budování politických subjektů v Maďarsku v dobách socialismu a kapitalismu. Prosím našeho hosta, aby se ujal slova.
Hello and welcome everybody to our presentation. I'll start and then I'll give the floor to Lena, who do some other part of the analysis. As you have heard, the title of our presentation is Workers, Citizens and Consumers, the Construction of Political Subjects During Socialism and Capitalism in Hungary. Now this study of of political construction of construction of political subjects is embedded in a renewed interest in the study of consumption under socialism. Originally, as a standard understanding, which was present in the literature on consumption under socialism, was that it was secondary to production and that it was characterized by shortage and monotony of goods. So it was not really something interesting to look at since it was quite boring. Well, actually, in the literature that is now growing on consumption under socialism, there are newer approaches to studying this phenomena, and then I'd like to talk really shortly about four of the strands that are now present in this field of studies. First, that rather than being secondary to production, consumption was actually quite important in creating legitimacy for the socialist system in the sense that there was a particular competition with Western countries on the standard of living. So if you look at official party politics from the 60s onward, you can see that the official legitimacy of the system that was promised to its subject was that socialism provides people with better standard of living, and that's why socialism or communism is better than capitalism. So there is an interest in this macro level of state legitimacy and consumption. Second, we can see that even within the circumstances of shortage and the monotony of goods, status competition and social differentiation through consumption could take place. And there were particular practices of how to make, differentiate products and how to differentiate oneself through the consumption of particular products. Third, as a third strand, there is an interest in the consumption of Western goods under socialism, which became quite an important strand within the literature as well as social practices, which links to this idea that consumption under socialism was a particular form of resistance. People consuming particular types of goods or consuming as such was a form of resistance towards the oppressive communist system. So our discussion is built on this framework of interest in consumption under socialism, and to see how consumption was conceptualized in the public discourse under socialism and how people relate to those discussions currently in Hungary. So the first part of the presentation will look at the public discourse on consumption in Hungary, and we did that through an archival discourse analysis of particular so-called democratic media debates in Hungary. These were debates that started in the early 60s in Hungary and went on until the change of the system. These debates were taking place in intellectual journals in Hungary, some of them weekly journals, some of them more serious journals of literature. And the debates themselves, as some authors say, were a form of a semi-official public sphere in Hungary. So rather than being these important discussions being located in parliaments or in official discussions, they took place in these media debates. Now, what these media debates, the way they worked is that there was an article published, and there was a wave of responses to these debate to this article. Some of the debates, for example, the fridge socialism debate, which was the first that we looked at, there were some 120 responses to the original article, and then out of these 110, there were 30-40 actually published in these journals. So there were sharp disagreements, but you can see which resemble political discussions. In parliaments, however, there was clearly delicate censorship, so it was not everything was allowed to be said. There were clear limits on what could be said and what could not be said. And another interesting thing was that there were also always a very important closing article which summarized the whole debate and gave an authoritative view of what should be the understanding of it, which was, of course, very much related to the official political point of view on that. So the topic of these debates was very often consumption and lifestyle issues. This somehow was a topic that was really prominent in these discussions. You can see that we identified seven of these debates that were really important in Hungary. I will not go into very much deep into it, but if you're interested, of course, we can give you references and in which journals these debates happen. So if you look at these discussions and debates, I picked three very representative quotations that show you the type of arguments that were put forward. So the first article goes like this: is it not the struggle for personal property that is responsible for strengthening egoistic, materialistic, and disinterested traits in people? If our man have achieved his desires, does it not dull him into a petty bourgeois existence to be locked up in his flat every day to watch television, to be isolated from the pedestrians in his car, or be separated from the collective social gatherings of fellow humans by spending time in his weekend house? So you see these notions of egoism, materialism, disinterestedness, separatedness from the collective. In the second quotation, still from these debates, some say sharply, on one side there is television, car, vacation abroad, and the crinoline, which was a type of clothing. On the other side, there is the declining political interest, unsustained attention paid to productive socialist culture, the reappearance of bourgeois mentality, morality, and individualization. And finally, another quotation: it is possible that a doctor, an artist, or even a miner imagines to rise above the society by having a car, and he hurls the world of the roads of bourgeois illusions, but on this road he bumps into the ethical iron wall of the community, and in that clash there can only be one loser, which of course was the deviant individual who goes against socialist ethos. So to summarize the findings of these debates, what we can find here is a particular set of moral problems linked to consumption. This is individualization, so the turning away of public life towards private life, a certain sense of materialism, so an interest in material goods rather than in... can you move one? Materialism, so that rather than focusing on culture and important things, to put goods. Another of these is that how the availability of consumer goods leads to laziness. People no longer care about working, but rather they fall into laziness. Rather than dealing with the important things, they deal with less important things. So there is this loss of authenticity of the self. And finally, a very strong notion of turning away from public life. If you can see that what happens in these debates is strict and strong binary opposition is set up between the socialist ethos that is centered around citizenship and being a good worker versus the deviant individuals who, rather than being good workers and good citizens, focus on consumption. So this was the socialist framework of how the issues of citizenship, workers, and consumption figures. And now I'll give the floor to Lena, who will talk about the how this resonates with current discussions.
Yes, thank you. So Tamás talked about the public debates in newspapers and in the political sphere. Now I looked at. My results are based on an ethnographic study with three generations of Hungarians. It was a study of three generational families. So the oldest generation was born before socialism, the second generation during socialism, and then the last generation in the last years of socialism. I'm now only going to focus some of the results from the second generation and specifically on the way their understanding of themselves and these roles of being a consumer, a worker, or a citizen relates to this dichotomy in the public discourse. So once again, as Tamás said, in the public discourse, there was a strict opposition between consumers who were seen as the prototype of the capitalist mentality to be avoided, and between the ideal communist workers or citizens as an ideal of how people should behave during communist. So I'm going to focus on this dichotomy and how it appears in people's own experiences. So I identified four type of attitudes to this dichotomy and more generally to socialism and socialist ethos. The first is what I would like to call the socialist ascetics. This is an approach mainly embraced by people who worked in the first economy during socialism. So they generally made careers in socialism, which was a very like hierarchical career for them. So they started their education, they climbed up the educational hierarchy, and then in the work and related to it in many cases in the party hierarchy. So in the way they talk about themselves, they have this very strong worker identity. So the idea that I worked very hard and I gradually achieved what I achieved by now or by the end of socialism, like starting somewhere down and gradually being promoted. And they see it as something very socialist as opposed to the capitalist system now where someone can just get rich from one day to another. So they see their own career route as something socialist as opposed to capitalism. Many of these people, at least in my research, have rather modest consumption. So even if they have money, they don't buy let's say branded goods, they don't buy a very expensive car, even if they have a big house, they rather hide it. So it's sort of ambiguous because on the one hand, these are people in the elite. At the same time, they don't show that they have so much money, which I think was also a central ambiguity during socialism. So they have on the one hand this modest idea of consumption. On the other hand, they are the ones who can afford the most consumption. But anyway, the way they talk about their own consumption is that they don't want to spend too much. They try to be modest, even sort of ascetic. And they pretty much repeat the socialist slogans that Tamás talked about. So that consumption shouldn't be the center of life. Consumption is secondary. And one should have these modest consumption norms. Now, the interesting thing about this view is that certain work-based identities are related to certain consumer identities of the modest consumer, just like in the socialist public discourse. And the way they relate these two aspects of their identity to each other is through the idea that if you worked in a legitimate way, which is gradually climbing up the hierarchy, achieving something from nothing is their very typical way of seeing their own life, then you will also consume in a modest way. So if you achieved what you have now from nothing gradually, then you will not waste money on branded goods, but you will also be modest in your consumption because you learned the worth of money and so it will be translated into a sort of modest consumption. So this is specifically posited against the nouveau riches of today, who they see as people who didn't earn their money in this legitimate way, and also against the aristocracy of the period before socialists, who they also see as not really entitled to their wealth. So they see their own position as opposed to these two social categories that they don't see as legitimate. Now, the second approach, which I call socialist consumerism, is mainly I mainly observed this approach among people who were workers during socialism, and they impoverished during capitalism. So they lost their job, or they retired, and now they are living on a very low retirement benefit. I call this approach socialist because there is a very clear nostalgia for socialism among these people, and they talk very frequently about their own role during socialism as something very positive. So a typical interview quote from these people would be, we have worked for socialism, we were building the country, and these sort of things. So they see themselves as workers, at the same time citizens, so they contributed to the socialist state as a citizen through their role as a worker. And they understand, so the way they see their relation to the state is that they work for the state, and in exchange they expect consumption from the state, but not private consumption, but that the state gives them certain benefits. So it's a sort of a mutual obligation between the worker and the state, and today they are very disappointed that they sort of feel that the state violated the terms of this agreement, that they work for the socialist state, and now they don't have what the state promised them, a satisfactory standard of living. However, unlike in the previous case, which is mainly, as I said, based on an idea of modest consumption, here we absolutely don't have this self-restraint. So these people, they for them, consumption is an unquestionable good. They would very gladly spend more money if they would have more money. They talk a lot about social competition, living up to expectations. So they have this sort of unrestrained approach to consumption, which is very different from both the public discourse and sort of the elite version of this socialist idea. Now, the third approach that I would like to call the conservative approach, I call it conservative because it's very similar to today's conservative discourses, and also it has a very strong nostalgia to the period before socialism, so it traces back its roots to that period, and also the ethical vision that is based on tradition, family, religion, and the idea of everyday ceremonies. People, even though they didn't live during that period, they trace back the origin of these ideas to that period. Now, for these people, the dichotomy is between the citizen and the worker. They have very positive associations what they see as a citizen, as opposed to the worker, which is a characteristically socialist figure for them. So for them, the worker is someone who is diminished in his or her humanity to mere productive roles, so basically going to the factory and then going home, lacking all human relationships, basically reduced to a level of basic necessity, as opposed to the citizen, who they see as characterized by more consumption, so like a bigger flat where the family can gather, these everyday ceremonies where people can talk to each other, take care of each other, like a big family dinner, and so on. So this is a very, very different idea of the two, what I call socialist approach. Yet, what is interesting, it's not only different, but there are very important similarities as well. So, for example, even people of the conservative approach, they have this idea of work-based entitlement, so you are only entitled to consumption if you worked for it. They also expect many things from the state and claim that the state should provide for their different needs. So it's not just the opposition. And finally, the last approach that I observed among people who worked in the second economy, so to say, during socialism, so private entrepreneurs or people in the first economy who were involved in sort of semi-legal activities, they have the approach that I call distance. So they they simply treat socialist public discourse as a set of empty phrases that should be ignored, and socialism, they just saw it as a set of annoying regulations that where they should find loopholes. So today they see capitalism as finally the end of those regulations, and they are the ones who appear in public discourses as the nouveau riches, because they don't have this restrained attitude to consumption. They see capitalism as finally the end of these restraints, where they can freely embrace consumption and so on. Few concluding remarks. First, I would like to point out that socialism has very different understandings. So I just described four here, but I'm sure that even within each category there are different understandings. And also consumption has very different understandings. You can't just simply say like, this is what I wanted to say. Then also there is a very strong continuity in ideas. So it's not only change, but certain elements of the public discourse during socialism is still relevant in the way people think about consumption, their own identity as a citizen or as a worker, and they sort of incorporate the new discourses into those previous ideas. And also there are very important overlaps, even between the rightist and the leftist discourse. So they are not so much opposing, but there are many important overlaps that usually we overlook. And finally, these understandings are never simply consumer versus worker or consumer versus citizen. They are rather different sort of ethical visions of how people should live that incorporate both consumer and citizen, or consumer and worker identities. So they are like these sets of ideas. So thank you for your attention.
Děkuji oběma maďarským referujícím za referát z pomezí sociologie, sociálních dějin, ekonomiky. Jestliže dva státy z bývalého východního bloku, a to Polsko a Maďarsko, aspirovali na označení nejveselejších baráků v táboře, pak v případě Maďarska, jak se ukazuje, tady to označení bylo dáno právě specifickým postavením v oblasti spotřeby produkce. Ukazuje se, že debaty, které byly legální, zacházely poměrně daleko ve srovnání se situací v jiných zemích východního bloku. Poslední referující v tomto panelu je profesorka Polina Brenn, která je historička, působí na Vassar College ve Spojených státech amerických, a její referát se do jisté míry vrací k té tematice filmového a televizního umění a trochu předjímá i další referáty, které tu ještě zazní v jiných panelech. Je nazván Socialistická identita a postkomunistická paměť v televizním vysílání v České republice. Paní profesorko, máte slovo.
Děkuji. I think I have to borrow that. First of all, thank you all of you for being here, and I do promise that I will be 15 minutes, or I will certainly be within that range, I promise. So you can all go have a cup of coffee afterwards. I am a historian, so I'm going to begin in the past before I move to the present, and I'm going to start at the Prague Spring, which began and ended, I would argue, not so much as a political revolution, but as a revolutionary experience of words and images. Radio dominated, but television offered proof of its potential supremacy by juxtaposing visual impressions with words, turning revelation and defiance into immediate and lasting pictures which millions of viewers shared in 1968. Television's performance as a unique communicator between state and citizens guaranteed its place at the top of normalization's surveillance list. The reformist head of state television, Jiří Pelikán, was swiftly removed in the first post-invasion reckoning, after which an interim manager was brought in before committed communist Jan Zelenka took over. You might recognize Zelenka is on the right. You might recognize who is on the left receiving his National Merit Artist Award. Zelenka would state television through the following full 20 years of normalization, that is, the 1970s and the 1980s. In the purge and punitive screenings that followed the Soviet invasion, television was seen as requiring a thorough cleansing. And in September 1970, Zelenka circulated a memorandum to department heads, informing them of the government's demand that state television screenings be completed by the end of the month. The reason cited for this urgency was television's role as, quote, a central, powerful political institution. Even when the screenings were over, state television remained under close scrutiny by the Central Committee and was vulnerable to further vetting and accusations of insufficient zeal throughout the 1970s and 1980s. For an example, early accusations were voiced by the short-lived Minister of Education and rabid purger Jaromír Hrbek, who actually also announced to his colleagues that he was outraged that publishers were not printing his works, even though, quote, they have paper to publish the works of Sigmund Freud. And Hrbek accused Zelenka of still allowing former 68ers to appear on the television screen, finding it outrageous, he said, that at the same moment that we are carrying out dismissals and expulsions of signatories of the 2,000 words manifesto, one of its initiators, Zdeněk Servít, appears on the television screen. In other words, the very reason why television was seen as pivotal to late communism by the regime was also the reason that it was forever vulnerable to reprimand, that is, its visuality. All of which brings us to the question of what appeared on screen during normalization and how it shaped socialist identities. In 1972, the Central Committee's conservative weekly newspaper, Život Strany, complained that, quote, it seems to be easy to turn a beginning singer into a star in our country with the help of the press, radio, television, and concert institutions, whereas we are still incapable of propagating outstanding workers and the daily activity of the officials. This statement shows how off the mark the conservative wing of the post-1968 Communist Party, best represented by Vasil Bílak, really was, because the Stalinist ideal of worker superstar was outdated by the 1970s. The pop singer had trumped the worker in both East and West. Blatant propaganda was out and entertainment television was in. Even Moscow knew this. When Zelenka struggled to calibrate normalization's small screen, it was Soviet advisers who steered him toward the DDR and its turn toward entertainment TV, initiated to counterbalance the accessibility of West German airwaves. Indeed, one typical anonymous letter to Prague's television headquarters said this: I wish you would all realize that a person, after running around all day, wants to enjoy himself in front of the television set, except that that very entertainment itself is as elusive as an autumn crocus. This letter, which interestingly echoed Soviet leader Brezhnev's statement that, quote, the Soviet person has the right to relax in front of the television after a day's work, confirmed other East Bloc findings. That is, the majority of television viewers with access to Western television airwaves did not turn to Western television for purely ideological reasons. They did not switch over, as Cold War assumptions would dictate, to capitalist television for its markedly different interpretation of current world events. In September 1974, a report on television broadcasting was presented to the Communist Party Secretariat by Culture Minister Miroslav Muller and Vasil Bejda, head of the Central Committee's Propaganda and Agitation Department. The report hinted at what was to become a vital programming genre for late communism in Czechoslovakia. The report said, it is state television's goal to creatively render the life of a person in a socialist society, his relationship to his work and his life, his ethical world, his internal, as well as social struggles and conflicts. The most ideologically significant, as well as the most effective and entertaining for viewers, is the dramatic genre. Previously, General Secretary Husak, in conversation with Zelenka, had stated that, in his personal view, dramatic pieces produced for television, quote, must crucially be focused on contemporary themes. Thus, the late communist television serial, a sort of contemporary-based finite soap opera, was born. Sociologist Irina Raifova has argued that the serial was understood as potentially the most effective television tool for socializing viewers based upon the parameters of the given regime. The genre had existed before 1968, but it expanded significantly in the 1970s and 80s. Indeed, with the serial's focus on ordinary people going about their lives in late communism, this was the post-1968 social realism. The master of the genre, as many of you who lived through this era know, was television writer Yaroslav Dietl, who, until his sudden death in 1985, penned the best-known and most-watched television serials, familiarizing the nation with the lives of various fictional protagonists, among them a local party secretary, a chef, a supermarket countergirl, and so forth. Throughout normalization, viewers demanded ever more television serials. A 1988 television survey here found that 82% of television viewers turned on their sets for serials. And considering most people had a television set, this was an enormous number. Political and social themes considered stale and unwelcome when pronounced in the clipped voice of the television newscaster or printed in the smudged black ink of the daily press found an eager audience when refracted through the private lives of a group of fictionalized characters and their problems in work, life, and love. As one article in the Slovak press at the time enthusiastically exclaimed, these serials so much resemble our own everyday lives that we're no longer sure of what is art and what is journalism. The result was that this cult of the television serial produced a nation that regularly, at the appointed time, sat down in front of the small screen to watch the latest production. A more recent commentator on the phenomenon recalled how viewers immersed themselves in the pseudo-world of these television serials, which carried idealized hallmarks of their everyday lives. In part, they did so because, same as the television heroes in these serials, most citizens of this state were not badly off. Same as they, most of the nation also lived with the absurd worries of those times, fulfilled the five-year plan, went to the May Day parades, and voted for members of the National Front. Under the conditions available, there was no other way, really. In other words, evoking the term used by Svetlana Boym in her work on the everyday Soviet experience, these serials became Czechoslovakia's shared commonplaces. When, in the late 1980s, Zelenka was confronted with following Gorbachev's reformist lead, he was not pleased. He complained to his colleagues of a recent cross-examination by a young foreign journalist who had demanded to know, quote, when at last we will begin with a restructuring of our history, and that until we do so, any other form of restructuring is nothing more than an empty gesture. Zelenka, by his own account, had been irate, pointing out to the journalist that the Communist Party had always waged an open struggle with this question. He said to his colleagues in the Ideological Commission, "What are these blank spots in the history of our party? We have an earlier period that was called a blank spot, the early 1950s. Comrade Husak got to know those years quite thoroughly through his own experiences as a political prisoner, and he managed, as we know, to conduct himself with honor, courage, and internationalism. But I ask you, in the interest of whom and of what should we start dissecting these kind of blank spots? A long time ago now, the party's central committee evaluated the main motives behind this period of history, and those who had been victimized unfairly were rehabilitated. Should we put on stage yet again that which was already staged to such an extreme in 1968? Zelenka concluded by sharing with his fellow communist colleagues the advice given to him as a young boy by a farmer. He had been put to work plowing a field, but was so anxious about whether he was doing a good job that he kept glancing back over his shoulder instead of looking straight ahead. The farmer's advice that Zelenka cherished still, he said, was for him to look forward and never look back. But despite Zelenka's wish to never look back, the end of communism by definition has necessitated some sort of looking back. And because television, particularly television serials, were so central to normalization and thus to lived memories of late communism, so television serials became central to remembering the past. The best example of this, of course, is the rebroadcast of the 30 Adventures of Major Zeman, Major Zeman. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this socialist product, Major Zeman was an adventure criminal serial about the state security forces produced in 1975 by Czechoslovak state television, actually in conjunction with the Czechoslovak Army and the Federal Ministry of Interior. The premise behind the serial was to chronicle and in the process rewrite the then 30 years of post-war communist history in Czechoslovakia. The serial's plotline began in 1945 and ended in 1975 with one episode devoted to each of these 30 years. The point was for each episode to center around a primary story based on a real historical event that had taken place in Czechoslovakia in that particular year. These historical turning points, now reworked as television episodes, were taken directly from the archives in the Ministry of Interior and reshaped to conform to then the Communist Party's interpretations of a slew of pressing contemporary issues such as agricultural collectivization, Czech emigres in the West, 1960s reform communism, and Prague's post-1968 political dissenters. Now, in January 1998, Major Zeman resurfaced in a now independent Slovakia when a private television station there began to rebroadcast episodes as part of their late-night program schedule. Much to everyone's surprise, the serial was received with enthusiasm, its audience grew, and bootleg copies appeared in the Czech Republic. By spring of the same year, Czech television, which was the heir to state television and normalization serials, was discussing the possibility that it too would rebroadcast Major Zeman. That summer, a nationwide debate took place within the Czech Republic on the pages of the daily newspaper Mladá fronta Dnes, with further commentaries printed and broadcast elsewhere. It was, in fact, I would say, the first public discussion about late communism in this country. On Thursday, September 16, 1999, the first of the 30 Major Zeman episodes was aired on Czech television at 8 o'clock in the evening, with an episode to be broadcast every following Thursday during prime time. For all of the 30 episodes, Major Zeman was shown without commercial interruption and historically contextualized within a carefully thought-out format that included short visual essays of press clips, documentaries, and also historians' debates that followed some of the rebroadcasts. But the irony that seemed to have been lost on everybody was that in the spring of 1998, at the start of the Major Zeman debate, Czech television was in fact already rebroadcasting another normalization television serial. Entitled Chef Svatopluk's Quandaries, it was Jaroslav Dietl's last serial before his death. Chef Svatopluk followed the travails of a trained cook who rises in the ranks of the restaurant industry due to his admirable work habits. The serial, produced in the mid-1980s, came at a time of ever-declining work habits and was consciously intended to help reintroduce notions of work discipline, initiative, and ethics into an increasingly lackadaisical workforce. Unlike in the case of Major Zeman, when Chef Svatopluk was rebroadcast in 1998, there were no accompanying documentaries or historians' debates, quite the opposite. There was instead an accompanying panel of popular Czech entertainers and public personalities. During the rebroadcast, at regular intervals, these pop culture icons exchanged witticisms and small talk as related to the serial's plotline. No less the hosts of this post-communist rebroadcast were the very actors who had played the role of Chef Svatopluk and his wife during the 1980s. Thus, at the same time that the press was filled with furious debate over the implications of a Major Zeman rerun, Chef Svatopluk was being merrily rebroadcast. The reason for this seeming contradiction was that Major Zeman was viewed as fundamentally and overtly political. The writers, producers, and actors in Major Zeman had consciously rewritten history, changing fact to fiction and fiction to fact. They had done this so convincingly, some now claimed, that they had been able to change perceptions of the country's history and its political realities among the viewing public. But in fact, Chef Svatopluk, I argue, far more accurately portrayed the experience of normalization. Major Zeman, on the contrary, belonged within the framework of Stalinist ideology and propaganda. Its format, the fast cars, the soundtrack, the chiseled profile of Major Zeman was certainly aligned with the light entertainment obsession of normalization. But the serial's overt aims belonged to an earlier age. This was also why it was so much easier to identify the nefariousness of Major Zeman and to argue over its rebroadcast. In contrast, the ordinary life of the ordinary chef Svatopluk remained entirely untouched by debate, although it was more accurately symptomatic of normalization. The experience of late communism lies in the shared, often banal, everyday experiences. Its memory, therefore, is not so much a question of digging up the larger historical truths, as was the case in 1968. This ordinariness, indeed the normality of normalization, can prove to be the more complicated and difficult truth with which to come to terms. Evidence of this today exists in any newspaper kiosk. Systematically, normalization-era television serials are being transferred to cheap DVD format and sold at newspaper kiosks and supermarkets for no more than the price of a cup of coffee. Normalization's television serials, Major Zeman included, are no longer considered a part of Czechoslovakia's difficult history, something to be critically viewed and debated, as they were very briefly in the late 1990s. They have since become commercialized and fully realized part of the national culture, something to be embraced, something with which everyone can and should identify. And on a closing note, I should in fact say that indeed when I was back here last summer in the Czech television archives collecting photographs for my forthcoming book about normalization, I was competing for images of the woman behind the counter, Žena za pultem, with the designers for the DVD cover. And of course, sort of academic publishing being what it is, my book isn't out till January, but the DVDs for Žena za pultem already available, of course, at your local supermarket. Thank you.
Děkuji profesorce Brenové, která byla poslední referující v tomto ranním panelu. Teď se přiznám, že jsem v určitém dilematu, protože na jedné straně bychom měli pokračovat od 10:30 sekcí Posterovou, ale na druhé straně je vhodné a správné o těch přednesených referátech nabídnout diskusi, takže bych vás rád vyzval, abyste vstoupili do diskuse, pokud máte nějaké příspěvky, kterými chcete reagovat, buď na jednotlivá vystoupení, která tu zazněla, ať už ta, která se týkala elektronických médií, rumunského filmu, České televize s akcentem na televizní seriály, nebo sociologicko-ekonomických záležitostech. Tam, prosím, je vzadu jeden dotaz. Uděláme to, prosím, přátelé, tak, že zazní tři dotazy a potom budou jednotliví referenti odpovídat. Takže tři dotazy vyslovte.
Já bych měl jenom připomínku k poslednímu, a sice těm seriálům. Seriál Major Zeman by měl být dán před soud a trestán za rozšiřování komunismu a nacismu podle stejného paragrafu, podle zákona. Existuje ten zákon a ten paragraf. Takže to je jedna připomínka k tomu. A já vám děkuji za pozornost.
Děkuju. V první řadě je dotaz. Prosím, počkejte na mikrofon.
Já, dobrý den, internetová televize. Já se chci zeptat, jak se díváte na současné promítání Majora Zemana na televizi Barrandov, kde tento seriál začal se opět minulou neděli vysílat, kde se prostě pomlouvá demokracie, kapitalistický režim a tak dále, jak o tom hovořila tady skvělým způsobem panelistka. Já si připadám, že bychom si tedy měli v tomhletom případě promítat i nacistické filmy o Sicherheitsdienstu a jeho úspěších, jestliže srovnáváme neustále oba režimy, že jsou si velmi podobné. Děkuji.
Děkuju.
Ještě jeden dotaz tam vám ve čtvrt, v páté řadě.
Fred, it's on the same theme. Don't you think, and that's in criticism of the end of what he was saying, it's not something that is embraced and accepted. It's a sublime aesthetic experience. I mean, I also like to watch Meyer Zeman, but it's sublime because it's horrific. I mean, in the same way that you can imagine, let's say, a contemporary radical feminist watching some 50s American sitcoms, Leave It to Beaver and whatever, that really ultimately stereotype women, and just having, I mean, it's horrendous, but it's attractive exactly because it is so ugly and horrific.
Děkuju, takže bychom asi požádali profesorku Branovou, aby reagovala na všechny tři z těch podnětů.
Ano, budu mluvit anglicky, jestli vám nevadí. I think all of these questions I can sort of take together. I'm certainly not arguing that these serials should not be shown. Quite the contrary. What my point is, I'm really quite shocked by the way that they have now been embraced uncritically as a part of this culture, part of Czech culture, not even Czech history. It's now been moved over to the concept of Czech culture. Major Zeman belongs to Czech culture. And so this is my concern with it. And to the gentleman at the beginning, I understand how you feel about Major Zeman, but my point is also that I think actually a lot of these more benign serials were in many ways far worse because people watched them even less critically. And they really, Major Zeman had a certain purpose, as I say, to rewrite history, to try to reintroduce certain themes. Whereas the sort of the benign seeming, Žena zapultem, Muž na radnici, and so forth, that was really to create these parameters, these paradigms. And it didn't mean people had to watch and agree with them and try to copy the way of living, but it gave people a clue as to this is how you will get something in this society, this is what defines a good citizen and so forth. So I find, in my opinion, the more benign serials were far, in fact, the more, as I say, the nefarious ones. I would be careful about conflating particularly late communism with Nazism. We must not forget there was a Holocaust during the Nazi period. And also, one of my main points in my larger work is that late communism was significantly different from Stalinism. They were really two extremely different periods of post-war communism. And this is something we have to begin to recognize and understand. And I think it's almost more difficult to talk about the 70s and 80s, precisely because that sort of those black and white questions and answers are not there in the 70s and 80s as they were in the 1950s with the communist takeover, with the Slansky trials, and so forth. I could go on, but I'll stop. Thank you.
Děkuji. Požádal bych další tázající. Pán vzadu v poslední řadě.
Yes, it's to the girl on the left or on the right. Related to your point about late communism being very different from the Slansky trials, don't you think that there's a perception in the West that Stalinism went all the way through to 1989 and then it was all a black and white situation? And don't you think that there ought to be a lot of education to change that perception? And how can that be done? Because if you read any American commentator, even the liberal press, you know, the New York Times, they still seem to think that America's big achievement is winning the Cold War and that it was a sort of black and white victory just like over Nazism in 1945. So what can be done to alter that perception?
Jo, další dotaz ještě, poprosím. Pan v první lavici z internetové televize a potom paní v šesté řadě na lavici.
Dobrý den ještě jednou. Měli bychom si uvědomit, že vraždění nezačalo ve stalinismu. S vražděním začal Lenin. Kdo si přečte historii Leninova knihu Terorismus začal Lenin, Nezapomeňme, že Gorbačov poslal do Litvy tanky, nebudu mluvit radši o Chruščovi a tak dále, nebo o Afganistánu. S tím vším všichni čeští komunisté souhlasili. Takže nikdo z nich se nepostavil proti tomuto násilí. Proti násilí od Magadanu až po Aš, nebo respektive po Jáchymov. Já se domnívám, že bychom, tak jako to bylo v Bruselu na třídenní konferenci násleších o násilí komunismu, si měli uvědomit, že Západ se dívá na komunismus jinak, střední Evropa se na něj dívá také jinak, protože ho prožila, a východní Evropa, včetně balkánských států, se na něj také dívá úplně jinak, protože prožila ještě něco daleko horšího, než jsme prožili my ve střední Evropě. A toto by se mělo dostatečně neustále jaksi promílat, aby si to ten Západ dostatečně uvědomil, že nějaké zlepšení za Husákova režimu bylo ještě daleko nebezpečnější, protože ti lidé si začali uvědomovat, že tady snad za toho komunismu to tady bude lepší, jenom proto, že se přestalo vraždit, to snad ne.
Já děkuju. Paní v páté řadě. Už jste.
My comment is also for Paulina. I would just like you to elaborate on what do you think are the reasons for such an absence of critical debate on what you've been talking about. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Okay, to address some of those questions. How to teach the Cold War. Yes, as a historian, I do find this very alarming, and this relates to your question, gentlemen at the front. I met a good friend of mine the other day, and she has a 15-year-old daughter, and she was saying, and a wonderful, well-educated 15-year-old daughter, and she was saying how disturbing she's finding it simply because her daughter and her generation seem to look back on or think about communism with a sort of nostalgia, a romanticism. And this is very disturbing, and I think this is part of the problem of conflating the 50s with the 70s and 80s, because when we do that, then this generation does not take the 50s seriously, because they look at the 70s and 80s, which so far have been portrayed in terms of good films like Pelishki, Bajzhni Leta, Pod Psa, good Czech films, fun Czech films, but it is sort of like, oh, normalization was fun. There is this theme going on. And so I think it's dangerous from both perspectives to conflate the early post-war communism with the late post-war communism. We need to differentiate. Of course, how to do that? Well, as many of my colleagues say, there simply isn't the material out there to give their students. I'm hoping my book will be corrective. But it is a problem. And I think, again, we have to be very careful because there are not enough material, certainly in the English language, to give to students about late communism, then they all end up reading Václav Havel, which, great, Havel wrote, you know, of course, Power of the Powerless, of course, a wonderful text. But again, then there is the presumption that everybody was a dissident, which, of course, was nowhere close to the truth. And so, obviously, we need new materials. And the last question, why this absence of a critical? I wish I could answer that. I think about it. There, as I say, this younger generation seems to be a lack of interest. But I think that a certain generation before them really failed, certainly in this country. But I would say, I mean, I spend this year I'm in Budapest at an institute there for the year. And I know Hungary quite well, and Hungary has the exact same problems, I would say, or certainly to a certain extent the same problems. So I think a generation maybe in their desire to forget, as I say, 70s and 80s were, I think, about implicating oneself in very small ways, but everybody was implicated in some small way. And I think people didn't want to think about after 89, and as a result, they failed to really have a critical viewpoint to teach a new generation about what late communism had been like.
Děkuju.
May I just put one little comment to it? It is horrible if people like to look at the old, especially the political series, but I would also say that some of the joy they have from it is very non-political. One thing is that it's an escape for them to predictability from the very hectic, difficult life today. Joyful, but still hectic and difficult. So it's an escape to predictability if you review the old series. And also, I think there's very non-political nostalgia there, partly because it was the time when they were young, when they were healthy, and so it's kind of a simple association of something good from the past. So I would just also look at not that threatening aspects of this horrible phenomenon of return to the series. Thank you.
I'm trying to make the point it's not threatening, but it needs...
Diskuse, jak se zdá, by byla ještě živá, ale já bych dal slovo posledním dvěma tazatelům, protože časové důvody nás tlačí k tomu, abychom postoupili k dalšímu panelu. Takže vzadu v poslední řadě a v třetí řadě odzadu.
My name is Nila Winkelmann. I work here for the Institute for the Study of Totalitarian Regimes. This is a response to Dr. Brin. I think I have the answer for you, and I'm afraid I have to fundamentally disagree with your notion that there are two distinct phases of communism, the Stalinist and the post-Stalinist, and this is why you don't understand why the young generation finds the 70s and the 80s nostalgic and so on. The answer is in looking at it the other way around, I think, and that is there was only one communism. And the 70s and the 80s were possible in this mild form just because there was Stalinism before that. You have to realize what happened during the 1950s and the 60s. This is when communism hit, and it's correct to call this time, it's wrong, but anyway, we call it the Cold War. This is when communism hit society with full force. You have to realize what happened in the 1950s. There was a huge wave of terror that rolled through the communist countries, which completely destroyed the structure of society, which killed, tortured, and eliminated the nation's elite. We've had bloody, bloody years of terror in the entire Eastern Bloc. And the aftermath of all this is that in the 1970s and 1980s, the communists had no work, because all the resistance had been broken. All the people who were strong enough to resist communism were either killed, or they were expelled, or they ran into immigration, or they were in prison, and they were, you know, their spirit was broken. This is why finally, 1968, we had the invasion, which did the rest, in Czechoslovakia. But this is why we could have the 1970s and the 1980s, when the communists were just sitting there with a perfectly surveyed society, with the secret police invading every sphere of private lives, and the people knew this, and after 40 years they had resigned, there was no resistance, the people who were capable of resistance were gone. And this is why after 40 years, or after maybe 25, 30 years of hard and brutal force, the communists could relax, lean back, and just let the secret police bring in all the information, and they didn't have any work anymore because there was nothing more to be done. And I would dare to argue that had Hitler and the Nazis in the 1930s not been this crazy, had they just had a little war somewhere and not a world war, we would have seen a similar situation. After all, the elite of the society is destroyed, killed, eliminated, sent into emigration. It is very easy to rule a society that is governed by fear and mistrust, and where every private initiative has been stifled in the very beginning. And a final remark I have is, don't forget that in the 1980s we still had brutality, and we had murders, we had the state killing opponents of the regime, we had people being shot and killed at the border, even in 1986, 1987. So it's not that everything was fine and easy in the 1970s, the 1980s, it wasn't. And the reason why we don't learn about it is because people who in the 1970s and 1980s were in power, they still are in power today. In most of the post-communist societies, I'd rather say in all of them. And they are still in parliament, and they are in charge of how the society looks like, how culture is being presented. They are in charge of teaching history. This is why there is no discussion, because our history teachers are the same teachers we had when I was growing up, which was 20 years ago. They are the same people. This is why. It's not the young people who are to be blamed. It's the people who are today in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who are dominating the society, who came from the normalization period. It is in their hands what's happening in this country today.
Ještě poslední dotaz.
I'd like to offset a bit a fascinating discussion of a very interesting indeed paper by Dr. Brand by addressing question to another speakers. Lena, I'd like to ask you if you discussed socialist era consumption patterns with the youngest generation of your informants, and if you did, what was the commentary on that? Thanks.
Sorry, did I understand the question correctly? Whether I discussed socialist consumption with the younger generation? Well, the younger generation, they don't have too many memories from socialism because they were born in the late 70s, so they were like 10, 15 years old when the change took place. And I did discuss it with them, and what is very strange is that they don't have a clear memory of the change, but that's also the case with many of the people in the second generation. So they can't really... So they say that it was basically a gradual process. So, for example, they say, like, yeah, I remember that Benetton or McDonald's appeared on the high street, and that was actually before 1989, and they just don't remember. It's not a clear line. And what they say as a major change is the growth in the available consumer goods. So they don't really see it as a political change. They see it as a change in consumption, but that was also the case with many of the people in the second generation. When I asked them, how do you remember the change, they say, well, I don't exactly remember what I was doing back then, but I remember that I lost my job around that time, or my partner died around that time. So they don't remember it as a radical political change, but something their own life was going on and something happened in their own life that they might relate to the change, for example, losing their job. But it's not that clear. It's not like yesterday we had communism and now we have socialism. Now we have capitalism. For most people, it's a gradual process in their life.
Thank you. Ještě profesorka Brenová.
Yes, I just wanted to respond briefly to the young lady. I think it's unfortunate. I think you misunderstood me because the point I'm precisely trying to make is that that late communism is looked upon with frivolity, and that majority of people were in some way, they were co-producers, let's say, of normalization. Thus, the way in which these serials, as I say, are now being mass-produced without any critical thinking, debate, discussion, nothing. So my point is that it is disturbing that communism is seen with this frivolity. And just on a closing note, when you say that the party could sit back in the 70s and 80s, as somebody who spent years looking in the archives for normalization, I can tell you actually the party was very nervous the entire time. Thank you.
Děkuji. A vzhledem k tomu, že čas notně pokročil, tak bych předal slovo kolegu Rybkovi, který bude moderovat ten následující panel. Děkuji všem referujícím a všem účastníkům této debaty.